an Osho Talk. The Secret of Secrets. Talks on the Secret of the Golden Flower. Number 22.
The first question. Master, after the tidal wave of events, and with the memory of a profound experience, I face new aloneness. Efforts to share or escape into distractions have bad results. Why do I cling to this habit of escaping aloneness? A few comments may help me for the task ahead. Aloneness is ultimate. There is no way to be anything else than alone. One can forget it. One can drown oneself in so many things, but again and again the truth asserts. Hence, after each profound experience, you will feel alone. After a great love experience, you will feel alone. After a deep meditation, you will feel alone. That's why all great experiences make people sad. In the wake of a profound experience, sadness always settles. It is because of this phenomenon millions of people don't hanker after profound experiences, they avoid. They don't want to go deep in love. Sex is enough. Because sex is superficial. It will not leave them alone. It will be a fun, an entertainment for a moment. They will enjoy it, and then they will forget all about it. It will not bring them to their own center, but love brings. Love is so profound that it leaves you alone. This will look very paradoxical, because ordinarily people think love will make you aware of togetherness. That is utter nonsense. If love is deep, it will make you aware of aloneness, not togetherness. Because whenever anything goes deep, what happens? You leave the periphery of your being and you fall into your center, and the center is all alone. There only you are not even you, but only a consciousness with no ego in it, with no identity in it, with no definition in it, an abyss of consciousness. After listening to great music, or after penetrating into the meaning of great poetry, or seeing the beauty of a sunset, it always happens in the wake of it you will feel sad. Seeing this, millions have decided not to see beauty, not to love, not to meditate, not to pray, avoid all that is profound. But even if you avoid truth, truth bumps upon you sometimes. Unawares, it possesses you. You can distract for the moment, but no distraction is going to help. Aloneness has to be accepted because it is ultimate. It is not an accident. It is the very way things are. It is Tao. Once you accept it, the quality changes. Aloneness is not creating sadness. Your idea that you should not be alone, that is creating sadness. Your idea that to be alone is to be sad is creating the problem. Aloneness is utterly beautiful because it is profoundly free. Absolute freedom it is. How it can create sadness? But your interpretation is wrong. You will have to drop your interpretation. In fact, when you say, I face new aloneness, you really mean you face new loneliness. And you have not seen the distinction between loneliness and aloneness. Aloneness, misinterpreted, looks like loneliness. Loneliness means you are missing the other. And who is the other? Any excuse that helps you to drown your consciousness. Any intoxicant. Maybe a woman, a man, a book. Anything. Anything that helps you to forget yourself. That takes away your self-remembrance. That unburdens you from your awareness. You mean loneliness, really. Loneliness is a negative state. The other is missed, and you start searching and seeking for the other. Aloneness is immensely beautiful. Aloneness means a moment when the other is no more needed. You are enough unto yourself. So enough that you can share your aloneness to the whole existence. So inexhaustible is your aloneness. You can pour it unto the whole existence and it will still remain there. You are rich when you are alone. You are poor when you feel lonely. The lonely person is a beggar. His heart is a begging bowl. The alone person is an emperor. Buddha is alone. What has happened to you has been aloneness, but your interpretation is wrong. Your interpretation is coming from your past experiences, from your past mind. It is from your memory. Your mind is giving you a wrong idea. You drop the mind. You go into your aloneness. Watch it. Taste it. All the aspects of it has to be looked into. Enter into it from all the possible doors. It is the greatest temple there is. And it is in this aloneness you will find yourself. And to find oneself is to find God. God is alone. And once you have looked into it without the mind interfering, you will not want to be distracted at all. Then there is nothing to distract. Then there is no need to be distracted. Then you would not like to escape from it. Because it is life, it is eternal life. Why one should want to escape from it? And I am not saying that in this aloneness you will not be able to relate. In fact, for the first time you will be able to relate. A lonely person cannot relate because his need is so much. He clings. He leans upon the other. He tries to possess the other because he is constantly afraid. If the other goes, then what? I will be left lonely again. Hence, so much possessiveness exists in the world. It has a reason. The reason is simple. You are afraid if the other leaves, then you will be left alone. Utterly lonely. And you don't like that. And you feel miserable even with the idea of it. Possess the other. Possess the other so totally that there is no possibility of the other escaping from you. And the other is also doing the same to you. The other is trying to possess you. Hence, love becomes a miserable thing. Love becomes a politics. Love becomes domination, exploitation. It is because lonely people cannot love. Lonely people have nothing to give. Lonely people exploit each other. And naturally, when you have nothing to give and the other starts exploiting, you feel offended. You want to exploit the other and not be exploited. That's where politics enters in. You want to give as less as possible and to get as much as possible. And the other is doing the same to you. And both are creating misery for each other. I have heard a man stopped his car deep down into the woods. And he started being very loving to the woman who was sitting by his side. But the woman said, "Stop. You don't know really who am I. I am a prostitute and my fee is $50. The man gave $50 to the woman, made love to her. When it was finished, he sat silently on the steering wheel without moving. The woman asked, "Now why we are waiting here? It is getting late. And I want to go back home." And the man said, "Sorry, but I must tell you, I am a taxi driver." And the fare back is $50. This is what is happening in your love relationship. Somebody is a prostitute, somebody is a taxi driver. It is a bargain. It is tit for tat. It is continuous conflict. That's why couples are continuously fighting. They cannot leave each other, although they go on fighting. They cannot leave. In fact, that's why they are fighting. so that nobody can live. They cannot be at ease, because if they are at ease, then they will be at a loss and the other will exploit more. Once you see the point, you will understand the whole misery of marriage. The whole foundation of it is there. One wonders why people don't leave each other if they are not happy with each other. They cannot leave. They cannot live together. They cannot separate either. In fact, the very idea of separation is creating the conflict. They cripple each other, so the other cannot escape even if he wants or she wants to escape. They burden with each other with such responsibilities, such moralities, that even if the other leaves, he or she will feel guilty. His own conscience will hurt, will pinch him, that he has done something wrong. And together, all that they do is to fight. Together, all they do is continuous haggling for the price. It is a marketplace, your marriage, your so-called love. It is not love. Out of loneliness, there is no possibility of love. Out of loneliness, people start meditating. Out of loneliness, there is no possibility of meditation either. They are feeling lonely and they want something to stuff them with. They would need a mantra, transcendental meditation, or all that kind of nonsense. They would like something to stuff them, because they are feeling empty and lonely, repeating Ram, Ram, Krishna, Krishna, or Ave Maria, or anything will help them to at least forget themselves. This is not meditation. This is just covering up loneliness, emptiness. This is just covering up a black hole in yourself. Or they start praying into the churches and in the temples, and they start talking to God. Now God is their imagination. They cannot find the other in the world, because it is too costly to find the other in the world, and it takes so much trouble. So now they create the other high there in heaven. They start talking to God. But they cannot live without the other. The other has to be there. They may escape into the desert, but even in the desert cave, they will be looking at the sky and talking to the other. This is fantasy and nothing else. And if you go on talking for long, you may start hallucinating that the other is. Your need is such that you can create the other through imagination. That's why the so-called religions have tried you to take you away from the ordinary available others. They would like you not to get married. Why? Because if you are married and you have a woman, a man, you don't need a God. It is a strategy. They would not allow you to be in the marketplace, because then you are occupied and you will not feel your loneliness. Then why you should talk to God? You can talk to people. They will take you to the Himalayan caves, to the monasteries, so that you are left so lonely that out of the misery of loneliness, you have to talk to God, you have to create a God to your heart's content, And then the deeper is your starvation for the other, more is the possibility of visions of God. And those visions are nothing but illusions, dreams seen with open eyes. It is like if a person is put on a long fast, he may start imagining food. He may start seeing food. I have heard about a poet who was lost in a forest for 3 days, hungry. And then came the full moon night, and he looked at the moon and he was surprised. Because all his life, whenever he had seen the full moon, he had always remembered beautiful faces of women, his beloved, things like that. But that day, after 3 days of starvation, tired, hungry, thirsty, he looked at the moon and he saw a white bread, a chapati, floating in the sky above the clouds. He could not believe his eyes. What kind of poetry is this? A great poet and the full moon looks like a chapati. And you all know that if something is starved too much, you will start substituting it by imagination. If you have lived in a forest alone for many days and you have not seen a woman, even the ugliest woman in the world will look like Cleopatra. Mullah Nasruddin goes to a hill station. He has a bungalow there. Sometimes he says, I am going for 3 weeks, but by the second week he is back. Or even after 7 days, or 10 days. I ask Nasruddin, many times you say, I am going for 3 weeks and 4 weeks, then you come within 2 weeks or even earlier. What is the matter? He said, there is something in it. I have kept a woman there to look after the house. She is the ugliest woman. Horrible she is. Repulsive she is. Just to look at her and one feels like vomiting. But I asked them, but what she has to do with it? You are coming early. He said, there is a story in it. When I go to the hill station, she looks horrible. But slowly, slowly, after 4 or 5 days, she is not so horrible. Then after 8 or 10 days, I start seeing some beauty in her. The day I start seeing beauty in her is the day I escape. Because that means enough is enough. I have lived too much away from the world, away from my woman. Now even this horrible woman has started looking beautiful. That simply means I have starved myself too much. So that is the criterion. Whatsoever I say, 3 weeks, 4 weeks, that is not the point. The real criterion is, the day I see the woman is beautiful and I start fantasizing about her, then I pack up my things and I escape. I know the woman is horrible. And if I stay 1 or 2 days more, then there is going to be danger. I may fall in love with this horrible woman. Loneliness cannot create love. It creates need. Love is not a need. Then what love is? Love is luxury. It comes out of aloneness. When you are tremendously alone and happy and joyous and celebrating, and great energy goes on storing in you. You don't need anybody. That moment, the energy is so much you would like it to be shared. then you give. You give because you have so much. You give without asking anything in return. That is love. So very few people attain to love, and those are the people who attain first to aloneness. And when you are alone, meditation is natural, simple, spontaneous. Then just sitting silently, doing nothing, and you are in meditation. You need not repeat a mantra. You need not chant any stupid sound. You simply sit, or you walk, or you do your things, and meditation is there like a climate surrounding you, like a white cloud surrounding you. You are suffused with the light. You are immersed in it, bathed in it. And that freshness goes on welling up in you. Now you start saying, what else can you do? When a song is born in your heart, you have to sing it. And when love is born into your heart, love is a byproduct of aloneness. You have to sour it. When the cloud is full of rain, it sours. And when the flower is full of fragrance, it releases its fragrance to the winds. Unaddressed, the fragrance is released. And the flower does not wait that what is coming in return back to me. The flower is happy that the winds have been kind enough to relieve him from a burden. This is real love. Then there is no possessiveness. And this is real meditation. Then there is no effort. What has happened to you is something immensely valuable. Just your interpretation is wrong. You say, after the tidal wave of events and with the memory of a profound experience, I face new aloneness. Please don't call it aloneness. Or if you call it aloneness, then try to understand its nature. Efforts to share or escape into distractions have bad results. They are bound to have bad results. Because it is aloneness, really aloneness. You will miss something if you escape from it. It is escaping from your own innermost treasure. It is escaping from your richness, from your own kingdom. Disastrous will be the result. Don't escape. Dig deep into it. Dive deep into it. Forget all escaping. That's what you have been doing your whole life. This time, no. This time you have to go into it. This time you have to taste it in its totality. You have to become it. You have to see it, root and all, what it is. And once you have seen it and lived it, you will come out of it a totally new person, reborn. I have been watching you since the day you have come here. I have continuously been watching you. I have been around you. I have been looking into your eyes, in your face. Something profound has happened, but much more is going to happen. If you escape, you will miss that much more that is on the way. No, this time, no. Many times you have been doing it. Many lives you have been doing it. This time, drop all fear, drop all memories, go into new phase of aloneness. It is really aloneness, it is not loneliness. You need not escape. If you escape from loneliness, you will feel good. If you escape from aloneness, you will feel bad. If first to share our escape into distractions have bad results, don't share right now. Let it gather. Let it become a cloud full of rainwater. Then the sharing will happen on its own accord. There will be no effort to share. Right now, if you start sharing, it will be again just a way of finding the other in the name of sharing. It will be escape. Sharing has to be allowed to happen on its own. You just go on gathering this aloneness. And one day you will see the fragrance is released to the winds. One day you will see the sharing has started. You will be a witness to it. You will not be a doer, but only a witness. Why do I cling to this habit of escaping aloneness? Because you have not yet understood it as aloneness. You go on interpreting it as loneliness. And I can understand this is how everybody does it. For the first time when you feel aloneness, you interpret it as loneliness, because that is a known phenomenon. All your life you have felt it. The moment the child leaves the mother's womb, the first experience is of loneliness. He starts feeling lonely. He had to leave his home. The greatest trauma that happens is when the child has to leave the womb. He wants to cling to the womb. He does not want to go out of it. For 9 months he has lived. He has loved the space, the warmth. And he has been so beautifully taken care of, with no responsibility, no worry. Why he should leave? He is being thrown out, expelled. He does not want to go out. Life, we call it birth, but the child thinks it is going to be death. It is death to him, because it is the end of the life that he has known for 9 months. He is shocked. He feels punished. And he cannot think yet. So the feeling goes very deep in the body. It is a feeling of his total being, not a thought. Hence it permeates his every cell of the body and remains there. That is the first experience of being lonely. And then again and again many more experiences will come. One day the mother takes the breast away and the child is again lonely. Someday, the child is removed from the mother and the nurse starts taking care, again lonely. One day he is not allowed to sleep in the mother's room. He is given a separate room, again lonely. Remember the day of your childhood when you had to sleep for the first time alone in a room. The darkness, the coldness, nobody there surrounding you. And it has never been so before, always the mother's warmth, her soft body was available. Now the child clings to a toy. a teddy bear. But is it a substitute? Our clings to the blanket, but is it a substitute? Poor substitute, but somehow he manages, feels very lonely, dark, left, thrown away, rejected. These are the wounds that go on gathering and go on making the idea of loneliness deeper and deeper. Then one day he has to leave the home and go to the hostel with his strange people, unknown. Just remember those all wounds, they are there. And it goes on and on. Your whole life is an long process of feeling lonely. And then by chance, some profound experience happens. And because of that profound experience, you have a glimpse of your being. But your whole mind knows only loneliness. So it transforms the experience of aloneness into loneliness. It labels it as loneliness. The experience of solitude is defined as solitariness. That's where you are missing. You forget the interpretation. This is really something new that is happening. New, so you cannot figure it out what it is. The only way to know is to go into it, to be acquainted with it. Just as Master Luther Su said, it is like when you drink water. Only you know whether it is cool or warm. Now drink this aloneness, this fresh energy that is welling up in you. Drink it. Taste it. And you will be surprised. It is nothing like that you have known before. It is freedom. Freedom from the other. It is what in the East we call moksha. Utter freedom. And after this freedom, love will become possible. After this freedom, sharing will happen. After this freedom, your life will have a totally different significance, a totally different splendor to it. Your hidden splendor will be released. The second question, why do revolutions fail? First, because they are not revolutions. Revolution is possible only in the individual soul. The social revolution is a pseudo-phenomenon. Because the society has no soul of its own. Revolution is a spiritual phenomenon. There can be no political revolution, no social revolution, no economical revolution. The only revolution is that of the spirit. It is individual. And if millions of individuals change, then the society will change as a consequence, not vice versa. You cannot change the society first and hope that individuals will change later on. That's why revolutions have been failing, because we have taken revolution from a very wrong direction. We have thought that change the society, change the structure, economic or political, then one day the individuals, the constituent elements of the society will change. This is stupid. Who is going to do this revolution? For example, in 1917, a great so-called revolution happened in Russia. But who is going to take charge of this revolution? Who is going to become powerful? Joseph Stalin became powerful. Now, Joseph Stalin has not gone through any revolution himself. He is a byproduct of the same society that he is changed or is trying to change. He proved a far dangerous czar than the czars that he has destroyed, because he was created by those czars. He was a byproduct of a feudal society. He tried to change the society, but he himself was a dictatorial mind. He imposed his dictatorship on the country. Revolution became counter-revolution. And this has been the misfortune of all the revolutions that have happened in the world. Because the revolutionary is the same type of person. He has been created by the past. He is not new. What he is going to do? He will repeat the past. Labels will be new. He will call it communism, socialism, fascism. That doesn't matter. You can have fancy names. Fancy names only befool people. Mullah Nasruddin went to a doctor and told him to check him and please tell me in plain language. I don't want any abracadabra of medical science. You simply tell me plainly what is the problem with me. Don't use big names in Latin and Greek. You simply say in plain language, what is exactly the matter with me? The doctor checked and he said, if you want to know exactly in plain language, there is nothing wrong with you. You are simply lazy. He said, good, thank you. Now give it a fancy name to tell to my wife. And the bigger the name, the better, he says. Make it as difficult as you can. We go on giving fancy names, but deep down the reality remains the same. Nothing happened in 1917. One czar was replaced by another czar, and of course more dangerous. Why more dangerous? Because Stalin has destroyed the czar. He was a stronger man, certainly, more cunning. And he knew how the czar has been destroyed. So he had all the ideas how to protect himself, so he does not go the same way. He created a greater slavery in Russia than there was before, because he was afraid sooner or later he will be thrown away. So he has to break all the bridges and he has to throw all the ladders that he has used. And he was more cautious. The Tsar himself was not so cautious, because he was a born Tsar. He has got it through inheritance. He had taken it for granted. Stalin has worked his way himself, and it has been a torturous way and long journey. and he has to destroy many enemies. After the revolution, he started destroying and killing all those people who can be in some way competitors to him. Trotsky was murdered because he was the next man, very close, and in fact more influential in Russia than Joseph Stalin, because he was an intellectual Jew. Was a greater orator, had more mass appeal. Stalin was nothing intellectually compared to Trotsky. He had to be killed. And there are possibilities that even Lenin was poisoned through the doctors. And then the years that Stalin remained in power, he destroyed all potential competitors, one by one. All the members of the Politburo were killed. He must have been the strongest man in the whole history of humanity. And he turned the whole country into a big prison. This is how revolutions fail. The first reason, because we try from the wrong end. Secondly, once a revolution has succeeded, we have to destroy the revolutionaries. Because the revolutionaries are dangerous people. They have destroyed the first society, they will destroy the second. Because they are addicted with revolution. They know only one thing, they are experts only in one thing, in throwing governments. They don't care what governments. Their whole expertise and their whole power is in throwing governments. Once a revolution succeeds, the people who come in power, their first work is to destroy all the remaining revolutionaries. And they succeeded because of them. So each revolution turns counter-revolution. Because the people who has brought them in power are more dangerous people. Try to understand, the mind of a revolutionary is a destructive mind. He knows how to destroy, he does not know how to create. He is very capable of provoking people for violence, but he is absolutely incapable of helping people to become calm and quiet and go to work and create. He does not know that language. His whole life he was a revolutionary. His whole work, his whole expertise was to provoke people, to destroy. He knows only that language. And you cannot hope in the end of his life to change his whole life pattern. So those who are in power have to destroy all the remaining revolutionaries. Each revolution kills its own fathers. It has to be done. And once those fathers are killed, the revolution has turned into a counter-revolution. It is no more revolutionary. It is anti-revolutionary. Just now it has happened in India. Jayaprakash Narayan led a great upheaval, helped the country to change its government. And the people who came in power, Morarji Desai and others, came in power because of Jayaprakash Narayan. But once they came in power, they started getting out of the hands of Jayaprakash Narayan. They started reducing him. They became afraid. This man is dangerous. And this man has influence over the masses. Again, he can prove a great problem. The man has to be reduced, utterly reduced. This happened when the British government was thrown out of this country. Mahatma Gandhi did that. He was the man. Once the power came to Indian hands, they started neglecting Mahatma Gandhi. His last words were that nobody listens to me, that I am the most useless person. And the people who are in power because of him, but nobody listens to him. There is every suspicion that behind his murder, directly, indirectly, the people he had put in power were involved. Maybe not directly, but indirectly. They were fully aware that he is going to be murdered, but they didn't take any precautions. This is indirect support. Morarji Desai was in power. He was informed that some conspiracy is on, but he didn't take any notice of it. As if deep down they all wanted to get rid of the Mahatma, because now he is a continuous difficulty. Because he has the old idea. In the same way he continues, he has his old expertise. He has always been against the government. He is still against the government. Now the government is his. But he goes on saying things, criticizing. And the government was feeling very embarrassed. They all felt relieved, although they wept, cried, and they said that a great misfortune has happened. But the deep down they all felt relieved. The same is the situation with Jayaprakash Narayan. Now he is feeling utterly left behind. Nobody cares. In fact, the people who are in power will be praying that if he dies soon, it will be good. And he is very ill. Half the week he is on dialysis. He cannot work. His body is getting weaker every day. And they must be feeling very happy that soon he will be gone. So there will be nobody who is more powerful than them. I would like to tell to Jayaprakash, I love the man, he is a good man. So good that it was not his destiny to be in politics. He is a non-politician. He is a poet, a dreamer, an utopian, a good man, as all dreamers are good men. I would like to tell him that apologize to the country before you die. Tell to the country that in your name a gang of power-hungry politicians has cheated you and the country both, that you have been deceived and the country has been deceived. Tell to the country that the revolution has failed. But not only to the country that the revolution has failed. Remember to tell this too, that all revolutions will go on failing the same way, because their very foundation is wrong. Revolution cannot be imposed from the above. Who will impose it? The people who will impose it will be part of the past. They will continue the past. Tell to the people that there is no future for political revolutions. Only one kind of revolution is possible, and that is a spiritual revolution. Each individual has to change in his being. And if we can change millions of people, then the society will change. There is no other way. There is no shortcut. And this too has to be understood. It is an inherent characteristic of any developing system that heroes emerge and are heroes only in the context which stimulated their creation. As these heroes overcome and change such contexts, the heroes themselves become the context to be changed. A certain hero is born in a certain situation. For example, Mahatma Gandhi was born because of the British Empire. He was meaningful only in the context of the British Empire. Once the British Empire died, Mahatma Gandhi was meaningless. The context was not there from where you can get the meaning. So once the context is changed, then the hero himself becomes a useless burden. Lenin became a burden to those who came in power. Gandhi became a burden to those who came in power. Jayaprakash has become right now a burden to those who are in power. And this is the history, the whole history. But there is a fundamental law working. It is an inherent characteristic of any developing system that heroes emerge and are heroes only in the context which stimulated their creation. Political leaders are temporary leaders. They exist in a certain context. When the context is gone, they are gone. That is where Buddhas are different. Their context is eternity. Their context is nothing a part of time. This is where Jesus, Zarathustra, Lao Tzu remain eternally meaningful. Because they are not part of time, their message is eternal. Their message exists in the context of human misery, human ignorance. Unless whole existence becomes enlightened, Buddha will not become irrelevant. That's why I say political leaders come and go. Just for a few moments they are on the stage. Only spiritual beings remain, abide. Buddha is still meaningful and will remain meaningful forever and forever. because enlightenment will always be a need. Politicians don't make the real history of humanity. They only create noise. The real history is something else that runs like an undercurrent. The real history has not been yet written because we become too much engrossed in the temporal things. We become too much obsessed with the newspaper, which is relevant only today, and tomorrow it will be meaningless. If you have eyes to see the point, become interested in the eternal. Old, ancient societies were not interested in the day-to-day too much. Their interest was deeper. They were not brought up on the newspaper, radio, and television. They recited Quran. They meditated on Gita. They chanted Vedas. They contemplated on the statue of Buddha and Mahavira. These are eternal phenomena. That's why I say the events that happen every day are almost meaningless, because the moment they happen, immediately they disappear, because their context changes. Political revolutions have been happening and disappearing. They are bubbles, soap bubbles. Maybe for a moment they look very beautiful, but they are not eternal diamonds. The eternal diamond is the inner revolution. But the inner revolution is difficult, because the inner revolution needs creativity and the outer revolution needs destructivity. Hate is easy, love is difficult. To destroy is easy. To create a Taj Mahal takes years. It took 40 years and 50,000 persons working every day. But to destroy it, how many days you will take? Just take a bulldozer and within a day the land will be flat. To destroy is very easy. So people become very much interested in destruction. They think this is a shortcut. To create is very difficult. And again I would remind you, because all political revolutions are destructive. They are capable in destroying. They can provoke people into destruction. It is very easy to provoke people into destruction, because people are frustrated. People are in misery. You can provoke them into any revolt. But the moment they have destroyed, the problem arises. Now what to do? They don't know how to create. And your so-called revolutionaries don't know what to do now. Then everybody is at a loss. The misery continues, sometimes even becomes deeper, uglier. After a few years, again people forget, and again they start thinking in terms of revolution. And the political leader is always there to lead you into destruction. My work here is of creativity. I am not provoking you into any destruction. I am not telling you to blame others for your misery. I am telling you, you are responsible. So only those who have guts to take this responsibility can be with me. But this is a real revolution. If you take the responsibility of your life, you can start changing it. Slow will be the change. Only in a course of time you will start into the world of light and crystallization. But once you are crystallized, you will know what real revolution is. Then share your revolution with others. It has to go that way, from heart to heart. Governments, social structures have been changed many times, but nothing really changes. Again, the same thing is repeated. That's why I call my sannyasins not revolutionaries, but rebellious. Just to make the differentiation. Revolution has become too much contaminated with the social idea. Rebellion is individual. Rebel. Take the responsibility of your life. Drop all that nonsense has been put inside you. Drop all that you have been taught. And start learning again from the ABC. It is a hard, arduous journey. And remember one thing more. Thus both coping system and governments begin as useful and gradually become counterproductive. This is the nature of the evolutionary process itself. Whatsoever happens on the outside may look in the beginning is very productive, soon it becomes counterproductive. Because life goes on changing. Life goes on taking jumps into the unknown, and your structures always lag behind. And each structure in its own turn becomes a grave. It has to be broken again. But I am showing you a way where there is no need for any structure inside. Consciousness can remain unstructured. That is the meaning of the word freedom. Consciousness need not have any structure, any character. Consciousness can live moment to moment without any structure, without any morality, without any character. Because consciousness is enough. You can respond, and your response will be good and virtuous because you responded consciously. Live consciously without any structure. So you will never be caught into a counterproductive system. Otherwise that too happens. You learn one thing, it is beautiful. But only for a few days it will remain beautiful. Soon it will become a habit. And again you will find yourself surrounded by a habit, encaged. Real life has to be lived without habits. You have heard, again and again you have been told, drop bad habits. I tell you, drop habit as such. There are not good and bad habits. All habits are bad. Remain without habits. Live without habits. Then you live moment to moment out of freedom. And this is the life of a revolutionary. And remember also, so in the light of their past service, do not blame any program for being counterproductive as you remove it. House cleaning should be guiltless. You will remove a program as it no longer fits your developing gestalt. But avoid the temptation to be harsh with the program you remove, because they were necessary stepping stones to get to where you are now. Love them for this while diffusing their power over you, for upcoming phases. Whatsoever you do will become a habit sooner or later. The moment you see it has become a habit, drop it. It is counterproductive now. It is counter-revolutionary now. It will pull you backwards. It will not allow you move forwards. It will keep you tethered to the known. It will not allow you to go into the unscheduled, unmapped, unmeasured. So whenever you remove a habit, don't feel guilty. House cleaning should be guiltless. And it should not be harsh either. When you remove a habit, however good it has been, when you remove it, don't feel guilty, because don't think that my mother taught me this. If I am removing it, I am betraying her. People write letters to me that how I can take sannyas. My parents have taught me to be a Catholic Christian. Will it not be betraying them? I have been brought up as a Mohammedan. Will it not be betraying the people who have taught me with such love, with such care, to be a Mohammedan? Guilt arises. If you are feeling flowing, free in being a Catholic, there is no need to change. But the desire to change is there. That simply shows you are feeling confined. Yes, your mother taught you something that she knew, that she felt will be good for you. But the context has changed. You are living a totally different life than your mother lived. How can she remain a teacher for you forever? Don't feel guilty when you drop a program. And don't feel either harsh, because these are the two extremes. Either people feel guilty, or they feel very harsh, antagonistic, angry. There is no need to feel even angry, because whatsoever the poor old woman knew and thought will be good for you, she taught you. It served its purpose. In fact, who knows, if you were not a Catholic Christian, you may not have come to me. It has brought you here. So whatsoever has happened in the past has been used as a stepping stone. Feel grateful to it. No need to feel guilty, no need to feel harsh. Whenever you remove a program, you remove it just like as you remove your clothes. When your body grows, your clothes become small. You don't feel guilty because a pajama you are removing and your mother had given it to you, but it doesn't fit you anymore. You have to remove it, and you don't feel either angry. You need not throw petrol on it and burn it and make much fuss about it and first beat it. You don't do that either, because you know it has served its purpose. Man is a growing gestalt. Every day new things are to happen. Every day you have to absorb the new. And to make place for the new, the old has to be gone. The old has to be said goodbye with all thankfulness. If you can remember these two things, never feel guilty when you remove an old program, and never feel harsh when you remove an old program, you will be moving towards the revolution. I am intending you to understand. A revolutionary is not really angry. Why he should be? There is no reason. Whatsoever your parents could do, they did. and they did with all good wishes. That is another matter, that whatsoever they were doing was not useful, were not making you free. But that was not their intention. Their intention was good. And they could not have done otherwise. They had lived in a different world. So remember, when you bring up your own children, remember, don't give them programs, give them understanding. Don't give them fixed rules, just give them vision to see things, so they can find their own rules. Don't give them knowledge, just give them awareness. That's what I would like my sannyasins to do with their own children. Give them awareness, so that whenever and wherever they are, and remember, they will not be in the same world in which you are living and you have lived. They will have their own worlds. You cannot dream about it. You cannot think about it. They will never repeat the same life pattern as you. They will have their own lifestyle. Give them awareness wherever they are. They can find a way. Give them light. Give them eyes to see, to understand, and give them courage to be free. Give them enough courage so that whenever they find something is not right in their program, they can put it away. They can drop it. This is love. Don't enforce any pattern on them. They will be living in a totally different world. So give your love, but don't give your knowledge. The world is changing so fast that whatsoever you give will be out of date soon and will become a burden on them. And they will feel guilty if they drop it. Or, if they really want to drop it, they will have to be angry with you. In both the ways, it is not good. So don't create that situation for your own children. Live a life of revolution and impart revolution to your children. Live a life of revolution and impart revolution to all those you love. Only this revolution will never fail. But this revolution has not been tried yet. Jesus was talking about this, but it has not been tried. Buddha talked about this, but it has not been tried. I am talking about this. It depends on you whether it will be tried or not. The revolution that can succeed has not been tried, and the revolutions that have been tried have all failed. The third question, you are known throughout the world as the Tantra master or the sex guru, yet in the 3 years I have been in your ashram, not only have I had less sex than ever before in my life, but thought and heard less about it as well. Will you explain this discrepancy? Just the other day, in a magazine, Cine Blitz, I came across a headline, and they say, I am the Hugh Hefner of the spiritual world. And what are you talking about? Yes, I teach you how to go deep in love. I teach you how to go deep in sex too, because that is the only way to go beyond. To go through it is the only way to go beyond it. But my goal is to take you beyond. Now this is a problem. And I'm going to be misunderstood again and again all over the world. People have become accustomed. They think religious people have to be against sex. And those who are not against sex, how they can be religious? These have become deadly settled categories. I am unsettling all those categories. And I don't expect the world immediately to change so much into its settled patterns of mind. So I don't expect them to understand me either. When they misunderstand, I perfectly understand their misunderstanding. I have no false hopes. It will take years or centuries for them to understand me. But this always happens. I am creating a new vision of life. The vision is so new that they don't have any category to categorize it. So all are angry. Mahatma Morarji Desai is angry. He is angry because he is sexually repressed. Utterly repressed. With no understanding. He has just repressed his sexuality. The story is that when he was young, it is 60 years back, when he was young, in his village, a man raped his sister. That shocked him very much. And he thought that sex is the cause of such a great crime. In fact, repression may have been the cause. Otherwise, who wants to rape one's own sister? In fact, sisters don't look very appealing at all. One has lived with them. One has grown up with them. Unless a person is very repressed, it is very difficult to fall in love with your own sister. Almost impossible. Love always happens with the unknown. With the unacquainted. Familiarity breeds contempt. How can one love one's own sister? But the man must have been lived in a deep repression. Maybe He never knew any woman. He must have been desperate. But what Muraji concluded out of it was this, that sex is the root cause of all crime. If it can drive people mad and they can rape their own sisters, this is the root cause of all crime. And he decided never to go into sex again. Not for any religious reason, not for any spiritual reason. And since that time he has been repressing. And the same was true about his guru Mahatma Gandhi. It was also a trauma that created his lifelong celibacy. His father was dying, and he was massaging his father's feet, and the doctor said that this may be the last night. He may not see the morning again. But at 12 o'clock in the night, when the father fell asleep, he went back and started making love to his wife. He went back to his room. And when he was just in the middle of the act, somebody knocked on the door and said, "What are you doing? Where are you?" "Your father is dead." It shocked him. It was a trauma, a great trauma that transformed his whole life, not for good, but for worse. He felt guilty. He concluded that it is the lust, the sex, that has driven him at the last moment when his father was dying. He has committed a crime, a sin. He could never forgive himself. So he renounced sex. And his whole life he suppressed sex. And only in the end, the last years of his life, he became aware of the suppression. Because the sexual fantasy continued to the very end. And then he started trying some tantra experiments so that before he dies he can get rid of sex. But it was too late. These people cannot understand. They will think that I am a sex guru. I am teaching you sex. I am teaching you indulgence. These people cannot understand. Who Hefner cannot understand either. Because he will see why I am talking about meditation. Why I am talking about spirituality. Spirituality, meditation, samadhi, these things will look nonsense to him. So neither Morarji Desai nor Hugh Hefner, both will misunderstand me. I am going to be misunderstood by the so-called spiritualists and by the so-called materialists. But I understand that is going to be my fate. I can only be understood by a new kind of being who has seen this totality, that man is both body and soul, and that life matures only through experiences. Sex can become a stepping stone towards samadhi. If you understand it deeply, if you experience it deeply, you will be free of it. But that freedom will have a totally different quality. It will not be a repressed sex. A repressed sex continues underground, goes on in your unconscious, on, and goes on affecting your life. I have heard once a wealthy old religious woman caught a burglar ransacking her things. She had lived her whole life as a celibate, almost like a nun. Listen, lady, keep quiet if you don't want to be hurt. Just tell me where your jewels are. She said, I don't keep them there. They are in the bank in the safe deposit vault. Where is all your silver then? I'm sorry, but it is all out, cleaned and polished. Give me your money then. I tell you, she said, I don't keep any cash on hand. Listen, lady, I am warning you. Give me your money or I will rip it off you. And he started feeling her up and down. I keep telling you, she said, I don't have any money, but if you do that again, I will write you a check. I have also heard another story, maybe it is about the same burglar. In the middle of the night, a phone call came to the police station. Somebody was in need of immediate help. The voice on the phone said desperately, come soon, come immediately. A burglar is trapped in an old woman's room. The police inspector on duty said, we will be reaching within 5 minutes. But who is calling? And the voice said, it is the burglar. If you repress, you will carry the wound your whole life, unhealed. Repression is not the way. The radical change comes through understanding, and understanding comes through experience. So I give you total freedom to experience all that your mind, your body want to experience. Just with one condition, be alert, be watchful, be conscious. If you can make love consciously, you will be surprised. Love has all the keys of samadhi. If you deeply go into love with full consciousness, alert and aware, you will see that it is not love that attracts you. But in the highest peak of love, in the orgasmic explosion, your mind disappears, your thoughts stop, and that is from where the nectar flows in you. It is not really sex that gives you that beautiful experience. Sex simply helps you in a natural way to come to a point where mind is dissolved. Of course, for a moment, the clouds disperse and you can see the sun. Again those clouds will be there and the sun will be lost, and again you will start fantasizing about sex. If you go unconscious, then you will miss this whole secret again and again. It is not sex that is keeping you tethered to the world, it is unconsciousness. So the question is not how to drop sex, the question is how to drop unconsciousness. Be conscious and let your natural being have its whole flow. And sex is a natural part. You are born of it. Your every cell of the body is a sexual cell. Repressing it is against nature. But there is a transcendence which is a totally different matter. If you are alert and aware, in your orgasmic moment you will see time disappears. For a moment there is no time, no past, no future. You are utterly here now, and that is the beauty. It is because of that you feel so joy. So much blessing showers on you. Now these two secrets have to be understood. One, disappearance of the mind for a moment, and disappearance of time for a moment. And these are two aspects of one phenomenon. One aspect is time, another aspect is mind. When these two disappear, you are in utter bliss. You are in God. And meditation is a way to let these disappear without going into sex. When you go into meditation, you will one day recognize the truth that in meditation it happens also. Mind disappears, time disappears. And that day will be the day of great realization. That day you will see why you were so much interested in sex. And that very day, all interest in sex will disappear. Not that you will have to drop it by effort. It will simply disappear, just like dew drops in the morning sun disappear. With no trace, with no wounds. Because if you can create it through meditation, it is far easier to create it, because you do it alone. The other is not needed. You need not depend on the other. Secondly, if you can do it meditatively, no energy is lost. On the contrary, you become more vital because energy is saved. Thirdly, if you can do it meditatively, then you can remain it as long as you want. It is not momentary. You can by and by learn how to remain in it 24 hours. A Buddha lives in the orgasmic state 24 hours, day in, day out. The day Gautam Buddha became enlightened and the day he died, there is a distance of 42 years. For these 42 years, he was utterly in an orgasmic state. Just think those few moments you have. They are nothing compared to a Buddha. I am teaching you a new kind of synthesis. I am all for that transcendence that brings you to Buddhahood. But it is transcendence, not repression. Through repression, nobody ever transcends. Through repression, one goes on moving and moving in the same rut. Repressing, you have to repress every day. To the very last moment of your death, sex will haunt you. If you really want to get rid of it, and I want you to get rid of it, but I am not against sex, because those who are against sex can never get rid of it. Hence the paradox of my teachings. Only those who are really ready to understand will be able to understand. Otherwise, I am going to be misunderstood. The crowd, the mass is going to misunderstand me. But I don't expect either that they should understand. I feel sorry for them, but there is no expectation either. So I never feel offended. I know the teaching is so new that it will take centuries to create criterions on which it can be judged. Criterions are not there. It is said when a poet is really great, his poetry cannot be understood. Because all the old poetries are different from it. The great poet has to create his own criterions on which his poetry can be judged. So is the case with a great painter. You cannot judge a great painter by the old painters and the old masters. He has such a new message that no old valuations will be of any help. So he has to create new values also. It takes time. And if it is so with poetry and painting and sculpture, what to say about enlightenment? That is the greatest art, the art of all the arts. It takes centuries. The last question. I am very much afraid that something unexpected is going to happen to me. What should I do? It is good that something unexpected is going to happen to you. In fact, if only the expected happens, you will be utterly bored. Just think of a life in which only that which you expect always happens. What you will do with such a life? There will be no joy in it. It will be sheer boredom. You expect a friend and he knocks on the door. You expect a headache and it is there. You expect your wife to leave and she leaves. You expect and it happens. Within 24 hours you will commit suicide. What you will do if all that happens just by your expectation? And according to your expectation, life is an adventure because the unexpected happens. The greater will be the adventure if more and more unexpected things happen to you. Feel blissful. The unexpected happens. Be ready for it. Make way for it. Don't ask for the expected. That's why I say remain empty for the future. Don't project. Let the future happen on its own. And you will be continuously in joy. You will have a dance in your being. Because each thing that will happen will be so unexpected. And when it is unexpected, it has a mystery in it. I have heard about a clairvoyant little boy. It seems this boy had premonitions. Once while reciting his prayers, he said, "God bless mommy, God bless daddy, God bless grandma, goodbye grandpa." The next day, grandpa died of a stroke. Then later on, the little boy said, "God bless mommy, God bless daddy, goodbye grandma." Then grandma was hit while crossing the street. Sometime later in his prayers he said, "God bless mommy, goodbye daddy." The father was really upset. He had himself driven to the office, but he could not work there at all. Finally, he decided to come home early, but he was afraid to drive back. So he took a taxi home and rushed in. He was greeted by his wife, who said, "What do you think happened today, dear?" "The most awful thing. The milkman dropped dead on the back porch." Enough for today.
The responses to sutras and voice recording on this audio format are the copyright of Osho International Foundation. Copyright dates 1953 through 2003. All rights reserved. Reproduction in any media is prohibited.